Get Rich Education is brought to you by Norada Real Estate and Highlands Residential Mortgage.
Welcome to Get Rich Education with Keith Weinhold, giving you information and ideas on the investment that has turned more ordinary people into millionaires and billionaires than anything else, and can provide you with more wealth and happiness than you ever thought possible. Now, here's your host, investor, entrepreneur, business owner, and educator, Keith Weinhold.
Welcome to Get Rich Education, episode 138. Hi, I'm Keith Weinhold, bringing it back with impact because I've got that drive to help you build your wealth. Well, what do you do when you've run out of your own money to buy real estate? You've probably already enjoyed leveraging your down payments for a while here by using other people's money for the loan. Well, what you're going to do is use other people's money for the loan and use other people's money for the down payment too. That's exactly what you can do when you've run out of your own money. We're going to discuss that with our guest shortly, but first, I'm going to have an announcement to make to you on a future show about Get Rich Education's first book. A Get Rich Education book? Yes, a Get Rich Education book. And I'm the sole author of the forthcoming book, and I can tell you already that my book will break some of the, I guess, rules of traditional book publishing. I've already told my book editor, which is basically the proofreader of my content, that we're just not going to take all of her suggestions from the old book world, and we're going to do things differently to give readers what I think they want. I'll tell you more about my upcoming book on another show. Today, we're talking about how you can profit from urban real estate investing. And then secondly, we're going to talk about real estate syndication, which is sort of a complex sounding term, syndication. But syndication just means that you can identify a real estate deal out there and pool other people's money together to fund that deal rather than using your own funds. And you get a piece of the profit by connecting your investors, whom are often busy professionals, to a deal that they just wouldn't have the time or inclination in performing their due diligence upon. And that's something that you might very well possess. Today, we just happen to be talking about more urban development and new construction rather than existing, but you can pool other people's money with syndication for urban, suburban, or rural real estate. You can do it with residential, commercial, storage, resort, a car wash, a parking garage, or most any use type. And, you know, you can even syndicate property that you already own. Yes, you can take property that's already in your portfolio and have a piece of what you currently own be bought out by others and profit that way. Now, we've talked about syndication before here with Russell Gray and some others. And by the way, Russell Gray is co-host of the Real Estate Guys radio show. Check out that show if you haven't. Let's meet today's guest. Today's guest spent the first 25 years of his career in the high-tech industry, including chief operating officer and vice presidential roles in those companies. In fact, he's been a tech company founder. He was awarded patents, and for about a decade, 54% of the phone calls in North America were routed by a chip that he designed, but he since made a turn. In 2008, he began investing in real estate, probably a great time to get in there, 2008, when a lot of people were getting scared and getting out. The past 9 years, his professional life has now been focused on real estate investment. He's Canadian, and in fact, today he is the president of the Ottawa Real Estate Investors Association. He's regularly on television and on stage across Canada and the United States. Welcome to Get Rich Education, Victor Menage.
Great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you, Victor. So tell us, being a Canadian and investing in U.S. real estate, what are just some of those big picture differences between investing in income property in Canada and the U.S.?
Probably the biggest is that most Canadian markets are very homogeneous. The difference between the top income bracket and the lowest income bracket is much more compressed than it is in the United States. The U.S. has much more diversity economically, so you have much more wealth, but you also have much more poverty. And you have those in close proximity to each other. So, for example, in my city, Ottawa, which is the nation's capital, a three-bedroom townhouse from one end of the city to the other probably only going to vary by about $30,000. You don't see that in American cities. You know, you can have a very hot gentrified neighborhood in virtually any American city and with lots of coffee shops and art galleries and all that kind of stuff. And you go two blocks too far and you're in the hood. We just don't have that here. But that situation in American cities actually creates opportunity. It's those dislocations in value that creates tremendous opportunity. And so our markets here are very stable. They don't fluctuate that much, although Toronto is an exception. Toronto has seen tremendous growth, primarily due to influx of population. They're adding about 80,000 residents a year. There's very few cities, even in America, that are seeing that kind of growth. But overall, I would say our markets are quite stable.
Yeah, so in the United States, you have more of this sort of class segregation. And now you've done urban development projects, and you've kind of found a way to, I guess, exploit or take advantage of or create value through this kind of geographic class segregation. Tell us about that.
Exactly. We call that strategy buy on the line, move the line. So what is the line? It's that line that I just talked about between that really hot neighborhood and the so-so neighborhood right next door. Now, if that line is a municipal boundary or a school district or a freeway or something that's not easily movable, it is actually quite difficult to move that line. But if the line is arbitrary, it's just because, you know, on this street, historically, it was a lower income neighborhood. It is possible to redevelop on the wrong side of that line and now start to borrow value from the expensive neighborhood next door. So, you know, you just literally buy on the wrong side of the line, redevelop, and now the line's on the other side of your property. Now, if you just do one or two, it's not enough to convince the marketplace. You do 5 or 10 or 20, and the market says, oh, I get it, the line has moved. And you now are essentially playing what I would consider to be a large developer's game on a small scale. You know, you're not relying on the market to set the value. You're setting the value by creating forced appreciation, buying at a deep discount to the expensive market.
Sometimes it's not so much finding the line and follow it. It's following it. It's sort of making the line and moving the line yourself. What cities do you do that in, and how do you identify that?
I mean, every city has that band of real estate outside the downtown core that has been neglected for 30 years. And, you know, we've been very active in Philadelphia, just north of the downtown in an area called North Philly. To the south, immediately to the south, is a very expensive neighborhood called the Fairmount District, where, let's say, a townhouse might go for $500,000. You go one block too far, and that exact same townhouse a block later is half the price. You know, if you redevelop, you can really create a tremendous amount of value. We bought a property for $19,000, literally a block away from the Fairmount District. We put a fourplex on it. We spent about $450,000 on that fourplex in total investment, and it appraised at $620,000. So we had a huge, huge amount of value creation simply by, because, you know, there were no comps. What other brand new fourplexes were there in North Philly? There weren't any. So the only place you can get a comp is the next closest thing.
So we're talking about urban infill development here, going ahead and filling in with a new property or new construction, or perhaps it's a renovation around existing properties that already surround it. So what are you sort of doing? Are you usually tearing a place down that's there? Are you starting with a vacant lot or both?
All of the above. If there's a structure there that we can reuse, sometimes we will. We'll often just demolish the interior of the building, keep the stone exterior, and put a new building on the inside so we have a lot more control, the finished product. I find the renovations tend to have a lot of surprises. So if you can control your budget from start to finish, it's much more predictable. Sometimes we acquire vacant land. Sometimes we will demolish. We tend to focus on doing what's called land assembly, where we will take 2, 3, 5, 20 lots and put them together into a larger parcel so that you can build something that's larger. We're always going after land that is zoned multi-unit residential. Occasionally, we'll try and get something rezoned, but that's a riskier proposition, both in terms of feasibility and timeline. And so we tend to try and do things by right, what's permitted in the zoning code. And if we get 3 lots together, that might be a 9-unit building. If we get 5 lots together, that might be 13 units. It's whatever the zoning density is going to permit us to do.
Yeah, so we're talking about new construction here rather than just buying existing, and I imagine there's niche and nuance around that, and of course your financing terms are going to be different when you're financing with new construction, and there are a whole lot of things that you need to interface with there, and there's always opportunity in every market and submarket. 10 or 12 years ago, you know, we had excess supply, and now we kind of have a national shortage of supply, so that's got to be absorbed somewhere, and that's accomplished with new construction.
That's right. I mean, we went through a period of maybe 5, 6 years where there was almost no new construction. So there was a lot of pent-up demand in many markets. The second thing that happened is that home ownership rates, you know, a lot of people lost their homes. So a lot of those folks still need a place to live. Instead of being homeowners, they became renters. And so the demand for rental housing has gone up dramatically. And I would say that home ownership rates are at the lowest level they've been almost since the Second World War. That's not a good thing for the economy overall, but if you're a landlord, it's a good time to be a landlord.
That's right. So with your development projects, what is your exit strategy? Is it something that you're buying with the intent of holding on to it for the long term, or are you looking to buy and then construct and flip?
Yes. No, it's a buy and hold, and our strategy is to create enough value at the start of the project that we can refinance maybe a year, 18 months after the project has been started and recoup our invested capital. So the way that works, imagine for a moment that the finished building is going to be worth, we'll just use some round numbers, let's say $1 million. So I want to cap my investment at $700,000 so I can go back and refinance at 70% loan to value, get back $700,000 from the permanent financing. I'm sitting on $300,000 in equity, but I'm able to return 100% of the initial investment. So, you know, my construction loan, whatever equity that I raised to build the building, that gets returned on that refinance. So our exit is an interim exit. It's not a final exit. It's an interim exit, and that's usually a refinance.
Okay, that's usually a refinance. And you're funding these projects with money from individual investors and other investors. So if you can go ahead and make them whole and return their complete investment to them in 18 months in this example, then everything thereafter is basically an infinite ROI because they've already got their money back, and yet they still get the ongoing cash flow from 18 months on.
That's correct. And plus whatever share ownership they have in the property when the property is ultimately sold way down the road.
Well, I want to ask you more about the raising money part, but, you know, we don't talk about urban real estate investing very much on this show. So while we have you here, and what are just some of those urban real estate investing issues that you deal with that maybe someone's not used to dealing with real estate issues in a city? What are your thoughts?
I take a business approach to real estate, which means it's got to obey the fundamentals, the laws of supply and demand. Sure, you can go out and you can buy a property and it's cheap, but it might be cheap for a reason because nobody wants it. We focus on areas where there's influx of population, where there's jobs, because at the end of the day, believe it or not, it's the tenants who have the money and they transfer the money to you each and every month. So if there aren't tenants with money, doesn't matter how cheap you bought it, you're not going to make money because what you need are those cash paying tenants. So that's what we focus on. And, you know, unless those fundamentals are there, I won't invest. For example, I will not invest in Detroit. And I know there's a lot of people who have invested in Detroit. They bought houses for $12,000, $15,000, and they're very happy. They're getting their $800 a month in rent. But for me, when I look at Detroit as a city, it's a shrinking city. They've lost 60% of their population since the 1960s. I don't want to be in a shrinking city. I want to be in a city that's adding population. You know, Nashville, Tennessee, adding 37,000 new residents a year. Charlotte, the fastest growing city in the Southeast. Those are the types of situations that I go after where there's huge influx of population.
Now, sometimes when I think about investing in more of an inner city environment, and this is something that sounds like you have more experience in than me, I've done a real estate investing tour or two in an urban environment. And, you know, I mean, the cash flow is kind of a known thing, and that's typically what we as investors invest in. But it seems like the appreciation component to me, let me know what you think. It seems like it's less transparent to really see what's going on. And therefore, with the appreciation, there's a higher chance that you'll get reward, and there's also a higher risk involved. And here's what I mean by maybe it's not as transparent as it is in a suburban environment. A lot of times in an urban environment, there can just be so much going on, you don't really know what's happening next unless you're really in tune with the neighborhood. For example, in a few months, there might be a new elevated train line installed over here, and yet one block to the west of you, they're tearing down a complex. You're not quite sure what's happening there. And then a new university campus might be expanding three blocks to the south of you. So there's so many dynamics. It just seems like there's not quite as much transparency there, so it's a bit harder to tell when you might get appreciation and when you might not. What are your thoughts?
Well, there's two types of appreciation. There's forced appreciation, and then there's market appreciation. Forced appreciation is something that we control. Market appreciation, we don't. Now, obviously, we want to be plugged into what's happening in the market so that we know that we've actually bought in a good location, because obviously we do want market appreciation as well. Oh, and I guess there's the third, which isn't really a form of appreciation, although it feels like it, and that's the product of inflation. So as, you know, our government prints money, the dollar itself gets devalued, and that has the effect of raising prices on fixed goods over time, and real estate's no exception to that. So those three components, inflation, you can pretty much count on that happening. That's kind of a marching train that's there's no end in sight, at least not anytime soon. Market appreciation, markets can be cyclical. So we don't control that. You mentioned a couple of things that we definitely look for in an area. We want those economic anchors. Certainly, if you were to plot a map on any city and look at rents as a function of distance from public transit, subways, bus lines, and so on, it's a direct correlation. The stronger connected you are to public transit, the better the rents. We see that in Toronto, for example, following the subway lines. The further you go, you know, you go more than 500 yards from a subway line and rents start to fall. And that's true, I think, in many major cities. We always look for those economic anchors. A university is a fantastic economic anchor. It is countercyclical to the economy. If there's a downturn in the economy, do people stop going to university? No, they don't. They continue to go. In fact, even more go because many of them want to retrain.
Right.
Its cycle runs actually counter to the economy in many cases.
Yeah, so it sounds like besides monitoring those signs, you're working at larger economies of scale so that, again, you go ahead and take control and help move that line and, like you said, force the appreciation yourself.
Absolutely. And, you know, we get plugged in at a very local level. Real estate's hyper-local. And by that, I mean it's not even city by city. It's block by block almost, neighborhood by neighborhood. And so you really want to get plugged into what's happening in the neighborhood. What are the major developments? Is there a new supermarket going in? You want to get on the mailing list for the planning department and the urban development department. All that information is coming to you in a timely manner because you don't want to be the last one to know.
Right. In addition to those sources, are there any online sources that you'd like to utilize to try to go ahead and detect trends in these urban markets?
Absolutely. We go to the land registry office or the county recorder office, and we look and see what's happening, you know, in terms of who owns what. You can drive down a street and you can look at the streetscape and draw a certain conclusion, but that doesn't tell you what's coming in the next 12 to 24 months. If you go to the land registry office and you see that, you know, one company has bought up 12 properties in a row, that's not an accident. There's something coming, and that's where you need to pay attention. That's the leading indicator of what's happening in a marketplace. So we go to the county recorder office, and we do this very regularly. We figure out what's happening, who's buying, who's interested. And some of these folks, you know, sometimes we might do a land assembly and decide not to do the project. We may then look at who's developing around us and then just flip that land to that other developer. We've done that a few times.
So that's another way to get your exit strategy. Because sure, if you discover that someone bought 12 lots in your area, you're thinking, what do they know and what are their motivations and how does that shape what you're going to do?
Correct. And we'll often talk with them and sometimes we'll even partner with them. Real estate development is not a competitive sport. It's a team sport. And if we're looking to raise values in a particular neighborhood, we also want to encourage other people to do the same thing because otherwise we have to do it all ourselves. If someone else is adding new product in the neighborhood and bringing out values, that helps us.
It's a team sport because it's a relationship business. And part of those relationships is getting relationships with investors that go ahead and fund your project. So we're going to come back and talk about that. You're listening to Get Rich Education. Our guest is Victor Menage. I'm your host, Keith Weinhold.
Are you having a hard time finding great investment properties? Unfortunately, the best deals are rarely found locally. Successful investing begins with the right properties in the right markets. Norada Real Estate provides everything you need to invest in the best deals across the U.S. Our simple, proven system will help you create real wealth and passive monthly cash flow. Get your free copy of the ultimate guide to passive real estate investing at noradarealestate.com/guide. That's N-O-R-A-D-A realestate.com/guide.
Are you looking to invest in your first investment property or grow your existing inventory? Highlands Residential Mortgage can help, offering down payments as low as 15% and credit score requirements down to 620. Their streamlined process is designed to help investors close their loans quickly and without any surprises. You need someone who knows cash-flowing real estate and can help guide you through the muddy waters of today's lending environment, so call Graham Parham today toll-free at 855-326-6802. The Parham team can help you purchase or refinance any of your 1-4 family investment properties.
NMLS number 195724, 12001 North Central Expressway, Suite 750, Dallas, Texas, 75243. Equal housing lender, not licensed in all states.
Hi, this is Russell Gray, co-host of the Real Estate Guys Radio Show, and you're listening to Get Rich Education with Keith Weinhold. Don't quit your daydream.
Welcome back to Get Rich Education with our guest, Victor Menez. Victor is the author of the book about raising capital. It's called Magnetic Capital. Victor, one thing that some run into in an urban environment that you don't typically see in other environments, and these often correlate with those coastal geographies in the United States, it seems, is that of rent control. And rent control, not a very capitalistic notion. What are your thoughts when government goes and institutes rent control policies?
You know, I wish politicians would read and study economics, because when you do, you would discover that rent controls long-term actually disadvantage the very people they're designed to help.
Right.
And that's the sad truth, because at the end of the day, rents aren't the problem. Rents are the symptom. It's like saying, you know, doctor, I've got a headache. So the government solves that by putting a price cap on aspirin. Well, wait a minute. That's not going to solve the headache. Aspirin isn't the cause, and it's not because of an aspirin deficiency in the bloodstream that you have a headache. There's some other reason. So what they need to do is they need to look at the root cause. The reason rents can be very high in some places is because the underlying real estate is expensive. You know, let's say I'm working in retail on Avenue of the Americas in Manhattan. It's not my birthright to have affordable housing on Central Park West. You know, it just isn't. And the marketplace has decided that that real estate is going to sell for $4,000 a square foot. There's no way that you're going to make that affordable housing. It's just not possible. So trying to impose rent controls artificially because the underlying real estate's expensive doesn't solve the problem. All it does is it takes that product out of the marketplace. And so now those people that own those properties are not going to rent them. They're going to repurpose them. They're going to turn them into something else. They'll turn them into condos. They'll do something else where it makes economic sense. And when that happens, you're taking rental stock out of the market, which reduces supply. And when you reduce supply, what happens to rents? Well, guess what? Rents go up. It kind of defeats the purpose. And that's just the sad reality. They really need to treat the root cause, which is if you need more rental housing, create the economic conditions where developers are going to be incented to do that. Give them a tax abatement. Give them something that's going to incent them to build that product.
That's right, absolutely. Because rent control, which effectively puts a cap on the rent amount that we can charge as investors, when we're going ahead and we have to face with that as investors, we're thinking, you know, now what incentive do I have to want to go ahead and improve my property at its existing use type? We don't have any.
Absolutely. I mean, here in Ontario and Canada, the provincial government last month introduced rent controls, and they're indexing rent increases to the rate of inflation. Well, guess what? Electricity rates went up 24% last year, but they're still saying the rate of inflation is 2%. Well, how does that work? So at the end of the day, if it doesn't add up, at a certain point, people will stop putting properties on the market for rental. And in many cases, landlords are not intentional landlords. In many cases, landlords are accidental landlords where they have, let's say, tried to put a property on the market to sell. They weren't able to sell it. Maybe there was a surplus of that particular product in the market. So they say, well, you know what? Rather than have negative cash flow, I'm going to rent it out. And then maybe try and sell it in a couple of years. So there's a lot of accidental landlords out there. So the notion that landlords are getting rich off the back of tenants is simply not true.
That's a good point about intentionality, and that's something that we don't think about a lot because as listeners here, we are rather intentional real estate investors. The last time that Rich Dad Advisor Ken McElroy was here on the show, we were talking about rent control a little bit. I mean, Ken and I both lean toward being capitalists, and overall, we don't like rent control at all. The one important point that he did bring up is at least there's some silver lining to rent control, because in high-priced areas, that way, if there is rent control, first responders like maybe police and paramedics can actually afford to live there. I can't think of a lot of other positives toward rent control, though, and I sure don't like it as a real estate investor myself.
Yeah, and like I said, unfortunately, it really just doesn't help the very people it's designed to protect. At the end of the day, investors are not going to experience negative cash flow on a sustained basis for years and years. They simply can't. That's not sustainable. If it means they're going to cut corners on the property, they're going to defer maintenance, they're going to do all those things simply to try and squeeze out a meager profit, they will do that. And what happens? The living conditions go down and, you know, we're no longer living in a first world country because people are living in third world accommodations.
The more government intervention we have into housing, the more society loses and the more the quality of life for everyone suffers. Well, Victor, you've really become a master and so skillful and so well known at going ahead and raising capital for your deals. Now, that's something that interests a lot of investors because us as investors, no matter how deep our pockets are or how shallow our pockets are, Everyone is a real estate investor, but since buying real estate is a high-dollar item, you know, eventually we all run out of our own money, whether that's sooner or later. So what does a real estate investor do if they want to get out of the rat race and they can't control property that they put into their own name? Well, one thing that they can do is go ahead and identify a deal themselves and pool money for investors and get a stream of income that way from going ahead and identifying the deal and doing the due diligence and having the relationships to go ahead and buy a large project. So tell us just a bit about how one might go about and do that, and how does one start raising capital and pool money and aggregate money from other investors, which is what's known as real estate syndication in the business. Tell us a little bit about how one gets started and the mindset around that.
Well, the first thing I hear when I talk to, in particular, rookie investors and folks that are new to raising capital, many people are very uncomfortable asking for money.
Right.
And so my response to that is, well, great, then don't ask for money, because I don't ask for money. What I do instead is I take people with whom I have a relationship and I offer them the opportunity to collaborate on a project. And that's a completely different posture. In fact, because I have a relationship with them and I have an opportunity that stands to make a tremendous amount of money, it would actually be disloyal to them not to offer them that opportunity. So it's a completely different posture. And when you do that, now it takes an awful lot of the pressure off. I'm never really desperate for money. I'm simply offering people the opportunity. I'm very secure in the projects that we're doing. I know that they're good projects and that they're compelling. And so I don't ever feel like, well, I need your money. That's never the case. If it's a fit for you, then perfect. Happy to have you on board. If not, that's okay. The relationship's more important. That's really the perspective. And when you adopt that, like I said, it's game changing. What I discovered when I started raising capital, and I learned the hard way. I screwed it up many, many times, but I also got good at it. And when I got good at it, I noticed there was a formula, and I saw other people who were good at it. And I really discovered that there were five basic principles. And when you meet all of those principles, raising money is relatively easy. And when one or more of those are missing, that's when it gets hard.
And it does come down to relationships. And when you think about relationships in a long-term perspective, and that there's really a long tail to building the type of relationship and asking a person to come alongside you more so than taking the posture of asking them for money, it's not easy to just go out and ask someone for money. It's not a get-the-money-quick sort of thing, right? I mean, you don't just meet somebody and say, you know, hi, how are you? What's your spouse's name? I know that you go jogging and skiing too, and by the way, I need $500K by Friday, okay? It doesn't really work that way.
It doesn't.
So there is sort of this long tail to these relationships. So what are some of the other tactics and techniques you do to sort of build a relationship over time with somebody so that they do have the confidence to invest in you?
You know, relationship is really the first principle, the first fundamental. That has to be a genuine relationship. If it's not a genuine relationship and it's utilitarian or someone feels like they're being used, that's not going to work. It really starts with relationship in the most genuine sense. The analogy that I use is, you know, think about romantic relationships. Let's say two people meet, they go out on a first date. There's a whole bunch of steps along the way, and maybe years down the road, they decide to start a family. But if you skip steps along the way, you go from a normal progression to creepy in a heartbeat.
Right.
And so my point is just don't skip steps. Don't go to creepy. And yet how many times in business do we witness people go to creepy? I connect with someone on LinkedIn and they don't even say hi to me. They're already soliciting me for something. That doesn't work.
Right. You friend somebody on LinkedIn and before you know it, they've added you to their email list. I mean, yeah, what a turnoff. They're advancing the relationship a bit too quickly there. So I think part of the intimidation was someone potentially being interested in real estate syndication and going out and asking others for money and kind of forging a relationship with somebody that's a stranger now. I think one mental barrier to entry to that person that's just invested in their own deals and wants to jump over that hurdle and become a syndicator, an everyday person is thinking, now, how do I get around high net worth individuals? How do I get around people with deep pockets that even possibly could invest in a deal that I'm contemplating for some large apartment building down the road? How does one do that?
Let me circle back to that because, you know, oftentimes when you go after someone with whose pockets are too deep, it's not going to fit. And that'll become clear in a moment here. So we talked about relationship as being number one. And number two is you need to establish trust. And trust is not just, is this an honest person? It's a whole series of things. It's a psychological contract. It's questions like, can I trust you to put together a good plan? Can I trust you to execute the plan? Can I trust you to hire the right people? Can I trust you to communicate in an open and transparent way, even if there's a problem? And on and on and on. And if any one of those things are missing, the trust starts to break down. Can I trust you with small commitments? That's very foundational. Third element is, what's your track record? Show me your results. That's so key, because people want to know that they're investing with someone that actually knows how to repeatedly make money. If this is your 10th medical office building, it's reasonable to expect that number 11 is going to go like the 10 that came before it.
Yeah.
If it's your first, well, let's see. So number three is results. Number four, you've got to have a compelling opportunity. And what's compelling to you may not be compelling in the eyes of the investor. It's kind of like, what is beauty? Is the image on the magazine cover beautiful or not? Well, it's a little bit in the eye of the beholder. For one person, it might be medical office buildings. For another person, it might be storage units. For someone else, it might be industrial warehouses with a 16-foot clearance. It really varies tremendously from one investor to the next. And the last element is alignment. And this is a whole bunch of things that come together. It's things like, what's the size of the investment? Sometimes when you're dealing with a high net worth individual, they have an investment minimum. It might be $5 million, because anything less than that isn't worth their time, isn't worth the paperwork. So don't go after someone who is too wealthy right away, because you're not going to be able to use their money. Go after someone who's a little bit smaller. Develop relationships and work your way up. I believe in something called the rule of three. So you might start out with a single family home, then go to a triplex, then maybe a 9-unit, then maybe a 30-unit. You want to take that three-step function every time so that you scale up. But you're not going to go from a single family home to a 100-unit complex. Very few people will, because you haven't developed that track record. Some of the other elements in alignment are things like, what's the rate of return? What's the tax consequence of the investment? What is the security? What's the risk? All of these things come into play, and you need a perfect fit on those, because the more sophisticated investors are very clear on what their investment criteria is. If you match perfectly on all of those, raising money is very, very easy. And it's sometimes seductive when you think that you have a partial match, but a partial match actually doesn't work. Something that almost works actually never does. Don't force it. It's got to feel natural on both sides, both for the investor and for you, the entrepreneur. It's really got to fit like a perfect, you know, glove fit. And if it doesn't fit, don't do it. Don't take the money. Don't try and force it. And so when you're dealing with high net worth individuals, again, it's got to feel natural. You might say, well, I'm talking to someone who's a billionaire and I'm not. Well, what do I have in common with them? How can I add value to them? They can buy anything they want. Well, oftentimes you'll find that there is something that you have in common. It might be a social cause. It might be a charity that you might collaborate on together. There can be other interests that you may have in common. It may not just be money.
And people like a story, too, when it comes to syndicating and investing in someone else's deals, in a sense. And especially higher net worth individuals that might have more discretionary income, they might be just as interested or nearly as interested in a cause so much as the ROI or the tax consequences or the asset type or when they get their initial investment back.
Exactly. For example, we're doing a project right now along the Gulf Coast where there's a tremendous amount of natural gas plants being developed. And so there's a huge influx of population, huge influx of investment. I'm talking tens of billions of dollars at a time. Every week there's a new announcement of another $8 or $10 billion project. Well, those markets need housing, and they need it very acutely. That's an interesting story. You can sell that story. And because it's real, there is that mismatch between demand and supply. So you're simply fulfilling a market need and solving a problem that other businesses have. And at the end of the day, that's all business is solving problems.
Well, you wrote a great book about investing in others' deals and aggregating people's monies for your own syndication. But before I ask you a little bit more about that, are there just kind of any final big picture things that someone should think about before they get into real estate syndication, Victor?
I think the first, probably the most important thing, and this is true of anything in life, if you look at the best people at whatever it is, you know, Olympic athletes, who do they train with? They train with other Olympic athletes who they're ultimately going to be competing against. Why? Because they need to be playing with people that are at that level. And that same dynamic exists in every industry. If you're starting out at a very low level, try and find the very best and work with them. Get close to them, hang out with them, go for drinks with them. The more time you spend in that environment, the more you will learn, and the more that environment will spill opportunity. I mean, one of my mentors, very wealthy guy, he was an attorney, his personal net worth is about $300 million. He did that on the side. And it's not because he was making that money on an hourly rate. There just aren't enough hours in a lifetime. He simply happened to be in an environment that spilled so much opportunity, he couldn't help but make money.
Right. That's a great way to think of it. And I think when you talk about that, it really comes down to track record, which is the third of five important criteria for raising money. If you begin and you don't have much of a track record, who you're hanging out with, who you're learning from, if you're the assistant on someone else's syndication, you can kind of borrow a portion of their track record and legitimately use it as yours.
Absolutely. I mean, imagine if any one of your listeners managed to find a job in Ken McElroy's company, in the MC Companies, and that's a very elite business. They're performing at a very high level. And so now you can take that resume and you can pretty much shop it almost anywhere. You can say, well, you know, I was working with Ken. And now that says something. People know what that means. You know, Ken owns like 10,000 units. And he performs at a very, very high level in every aspect of his business. I got to spend a lot of high quality time with him about a month ago, and I'm very impressed with him. He's a real sharp guy. But it doesn't have to be Ken. It could be anybody who's performing at that elite level. Hang out with them, learn from them, spend time with them, go work with them, and you'll rise to that level.
Well, I'm really glad that you wrote a book about raising money called Magnetic Capital. And you know, part of the reason why that is because to raise money in a syndication, you don't need some specific certification or piece of paper. You sure don't need a degree from any sort of formal institution. You just need knowledge like you get in your book, Magnetic Capital, and you need relationships and more. And just before anyone gets too excited about this, you know, there are some SEC compliant things to get with, as I'm sure Victor would tell you. So don't just go pull a whole bunch of your buddy's money to buy a 150-unit complex next Friday. But just tell us a little bit more about why you wrote the book Magnetic Capital, Victor.
What I found is that there really weren't many books on the topic in existence. There's very few people teaching it. I think the ones who are doing it well, they're too busy making money to bother teaching it. So I really saw a need in the marketplace. That was probably the number one reason. And, you know, it's funny. I was actually on another radio show. I was originally planning to write another book. I was working on another book, and I was on a radio show, and my business coach actually heard the interview, and he said, Victor, there's a book there. So I said, yeah, you're probably right. But he said, no, you have to write that book. And so I outlined 13 chapters that night and realized, yeah, he's right. So I put my other book on the side and wrote Magnetic Capital first. And I'm glad I did. You know, the feedback that I've been receiving from people who have received advanced copies has been tremendous. And, you know, I've got some very high quality endorsements on the back cover, which I'm very blessed. I was also very blessed to have Robert Helms, one of the real estate guys, write the foreword of the book.
Yeah.
So I've had some, you know, very good contributors both to the book itself as well as reviewing it. So I'm very blessed.
Well, how can someone get a hold of Magnetic Capital, and how can our listeners connect with you?
You can order directly from our website at victorjm.com. That's victorjm.com. It will be out late towards the end of June on Amazon. We're launching in June, but it's not on Amazon yet. So in the meantime, order it from victorjm.com. And if you want to get in touch with me directly, you can just email me at victor@victorjm.com. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Victor Menage, it's been valuable. Thanks so much for coming on to Get Rich Education.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Well, I like how Victor talks about moving the line, that dividing line between a higher class area and a distinctly lower class area within an urban environment. You can identify a submarket like he has near that border where the line is gray, and with some scale, you can actually move that line and add value that way. That's exploiting an opportunity like he's doing in Philadelphia and doing it outside of his Ontario market, since there's less of a class distinction there in his home country of Canada. And I know what he's talking about in Philly there, where, for example, you've long had that line between Center City and North Philly as you move north on Broad Street. New construction is a great way to serve a larger picture need, too, as there's a national shortage of supply, and so new construction has got to bring more inventory online. Think about where people are moving. You've got more people moving to urban areas, and this is after years of decennial censuses where the population had previously suburbanized more. So this is serving a need. It's using a trend as your friend, and it's being creative all at the same time. So I really like talking to Victor so much here. One thing you can do as an investor that's run out of your own money for deals is that next level thing. Be a syndicator by buying a distressed asset that might not have high occupancy because it's fallen into deferred maintenance. Buy it with your investor's money, renovate it, then get higher occupancy and higher rents following that renovation. Then get the higher appraisal so that you can refinance, say, 18 months after your initial purchase, and then you can return 100% of your investors' initial investment back to those investors. And now with their money back, they essentially have an infinite ROI going forward. And then think about how likely they're going to be to want to invest with you again. That's sort of the classic buy, renovate, and refi strategy, and you're doing it largely with other people's money. If you think that you can't find opportunity in circumstances and that limits what you can do now, well then make opportunity and create positive circumstances like Victor's doing. Now, 2 weeks ago, we did an episode about how to give yourself a pay raise and how to give yourself a promotion. And if you remember, giving yourself a promotion had to do with you focusing on outsourcing your self-management to a property manager, and that way you've promoted yourself to a higher use task. Now, if someone thought, well, maybe they want to keep self-managing because they like real estate and they just don't know what a better and higher use of their time is, well, one thing you can do is ditch management and you could promote yourself to syndication. That's potentially a better and higher use of your time than self-management. Or maybe you just are that busy person that wants to invest passively, and that's okay too. So if you want to learn more to see if real estate syndication is that right next level thing for you, I'd tell you three things. Number one, check out Victor's book, Magnetic Capital, to see if syndication might be right for you. Victor also has a magnetism scorecard on his website so that you can check your interests and abilities against those five fundamentals of raising capital to see how magnetic you might be in raising capital. Secondly, if that seems to fit your interests, you can attend the Real Estate Guys Secrets of Successful Syndication Seminar, which I've attended before, and you can learn more about that event at getricheducation.com/events. Victor is part of the faculty there. And there, I like how they say that this is how you can get rich by helping rich people get richer. You'll also learn the legal. Then thirdly and finally, you can potentially join that group's Syndication Mentoring Club for even more help. In fact, Get Rich Education's own John Collins just joined that club. Again, start with Victor and his resources at victorjm.com. Thanks today to the talented Victor Minaj. I'll be back with you next week to what? Help you build your wealth. What else? Don't quit your daydream.
You've been listening to Get Rich Education, telling you what the wealthy won't tell you about real estate and investing.
Nothing on this show should be considered specific, personal, or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, financial, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own. Information is not guaranteed. All investment strategies have the potential for profit or loss. The host is operating on behalf of Get Rich Education, LLC, exclusively.
Flow real estate investors nationwide and worldwide, this is Get Rich Education's Keith Weinhold. Forbes has rated Memphis, Tennessee as the number one cash flowing market in the world. Our good friends at Mid-South Homebuyers have been Memphis's premier turnkey real estate provider for 14 years with a stellar reputation and an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. Owner Terry Kerr was born and raised in Memphis. Yeah, he knows the market and has renovated and sold over 1,000 houses in the Memphis area. Find out what their many repeat buyers already know. Their houses are completely renovated, even come with a one-year builder's warranty and a lifelong rental guarantee. They're a perfect fit for the first-time out-of-state investor or the seasoned investor diversifying their portfolio. Mid-South Homebuyers' friendly staff makes investing easy. Learn more at MidSouthHomebuyers.com or give them a call at 901-217-HOME. The preceding program was brought to you by your home for wealth building, GetRichEducation.com.